Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and today we are continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds. Later in the program, Dr. Jim Garrison, who is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies. He is an international scholar, and he will be talking about how the Clinton-Obama Democratic machine has posed as if they were liberal and progressive. As you will find, they are neither. In fact, they are more conservative, more radical in their conservative ethics than anyone could imagine. We will lay that clear and bare today. I'll be sharing insights that I have written about, as well as we'll talk about the collapse of the middle class with Paul Buchheit from Common Dreams. We'll also share some very probing discussion with William I. Robinson, Truth Out, Sadistic Capitalism, The Urgent Matters for Humanity in Global Crisis. And on, in addition, I will be giving what I consider the real picture of what is occurring now, has been, and will continue to be. It's only going to get worse. But how did they get away with it? How did they fool us into believing that 1% of the population has all the wealth and the 99% are suffering, and somehow it's our fault if we're suffering? These are not accurate numbers, but accurate numbers indeed I will share with you on our program. I'll show you who's really in control of America, why we will not have a revolution, why we will not see any social change, and yet the people who are controlling it are extremely clever. Let's begin. One of the things that we're not paying attention to in the United States is the loss of the middle-class job. If you believe the official statistics, and you should not, it's only 5% unemployment. How could it be 5% unemployment when you have over 96 million, minimally, as high as 105 million, unofficially, people out of work who could work? That brings up to closer to about 28% unemployment. Now you're up where Spain is, and Portugal. Higher than even France or Greece. How is it that we say we're prospering and the economy's great? Look at the Wall Street people. Look at the hedge funds. Look at the equity partnerships. Look at the mergers and acquisitions. Look at all the companies being purchased. How could we not be prospering? Look at all the shows and reality programs about how people are doing so well. What they're not showing you is the collapse of the middle class. Yes, we have jobs within the middle class, sometimes two or three, to make up what at one time, 40 years ago, would have been a living wage. Today, it's a suffering wage. And yet people with college degrees, advanced degrees, adjunct professors, are doing menial work today, if they can find it. And yet that is not highlighted, because if it were, you would have to see that we have millions upon tens of millions of people who are educated, could work, and can't find the job. And we're going to put each piece of this puzzle together. The first piece of the puzzle is you cannot focus upon one segment of society at the exclusion of all others. You can't say that there's poor people, we know that, but they don't count in the political agenda because they have no advocates. So they simply suffer in silence. They're forgotten. And you can't say that we only have rich or poor. That wouldn't be correct. We have multiple groups within our society. I'll break down the numbers. First, we have 1/10 of 1%. Those are the uber-rich. 66 billionaires control as much wealth as 50% of the entire population. That's 3.5 billion people, 66 individuals. Now, if these people were really on the high side of their spiritual equation, they would be doing things that would benefit all of humanity. For example, it would not take much. In fact, if each Uber billionaire donated simply $5 billion, we could change all of Africa. We could reforest much of it. We could put in wells where they have no water. We could help in moving populations to more sustainable environments. But we don't have that happening. What you have is Bill Gates, who gets tax deductions by putting money into his foundation that then buys stock into pharmaceutical companies that make manufacture vaccines, then he advocates vaccine programs paid for by his foundation, which is tax deductible again, but he makes profit on the stock because the company that he funded, he now owns stock in, and they're advocating vaccines. Do the vaccines prevent disease? Do they have hard evidence? No, they do not. But they do have a lot of anomalies and harsh consequences. If you want to help the people overcome diseases in Africa, give them clean water, clean food, and a safe environment. That doesn't seem to be on anyone's agenda, not the super rich. The super rich seem to have an entirely different worldview. They believe that they should rule. These are people who I personally believe would qualify easily as sociopathic. They're extreme narcissists because they believe that if there's to be anyone ruling, it should be them. And they want to make sure they protect their assets, so they hire legions of technocrats, the best and brightest out of all the major Ivy League schools, and they set up foundations and think tanks. These are the individuals at these think tanks with good backgrounds and degrees, nice credentials and pedigrees, that go forth before Congress and argue for a law or state capitals or in television. They're the ones you see saying, we need to get in there and knock out Libya because it poses a threat to its own people. It did not, as you will see later. And they've got weapons of mass destruction. They did not. And lots of people knew they did not, including some of the people within the CIA who are being asked, in effect, to lie. But these are the people who decide making money and having power are the two most important virtues in life. The consequences to the other people are immaterial to them. Then you have the what we call the 1%, but they're not really 1%. They're closer to 3%. And that 3% are the multimillionaires. They would have above $10 million in minus their homes and in actual liquid asset. These are people who are neither policymakers nor opinion leaders, but they're always trying to be close to those who are. If there's a new place to eat, they want to be there. If there's a new fashion bag, they want to own it. If there's a new cosmetic procedure, they'll sign up for it. A place to go and to circulate with others, they want to get in. But in and of themselves, they do not contribute to the larger social contract. Then you have your professional class. The professional class, anywhere from 8 to 10 million people, lawyers, doctors, engineers, CPAs, professors, these are people, scientists, who are highly skilled, well-educated, and generally successful in their profession. They are not millionaires, most of them. They may total with their property have something, depending upon what they invested in and when and how long they've had it, but by and large, they have to work. And part of the reason they have to work is because this is a class that seems extraordinarily envious of those who have more. If their kids are not in the right private school, they become angst-ridden. So a lot of what they do each day in their professions as Wall Street brokers or as physicians is to gain more capital, an asset, to which they can then elevate themselves within the social hierarchy. Not everyone, but a lot of them. As a result, they're always chasing the uber-rich and the more rich. And also, they're more reliable to indebt themselves, to take risks, to join black investment funds where you pour your money into a fund to buy something, to flip it, and there's great risk in that because you could lose everything, but they're easily sold and they sell themselves. Whatever they have is never enough. They want more. So what is the likelihood as a group, not individually, individually they could, but as a group, they're going to stop and say, are we doing any of these medical procedures just because they're profitable, like chemotherapy, which can run $200,000 for a treatment over a two-year period, where they actually profit from that? How likely they are to say to a person, this is not a stock or fund or bond you want to invest in. I don't believe in it. Knowing if they said that, they wouldn't get a commission. How likely are they to try a drug, for example, because they get a profit from the drug? They're not even questioning the ethic of how they're practicing medicine, let alone how they're being nothing more than a service provider for the pharmaceutical industry. And what about those people in the fracking industry? Do they ever stop for a moment and say, I just invested in a new fracking site out in Oklahoma, and it looks like we'll be able to make money within a year to two, and a lot of it. And I only invested $400,000, or about half of what I actually own. And someone says, you you realize that gas hydrofracking, they have to put that toxic water back into the ground, and that's polluting underground wells and aquifers. It's increasing earthquakes. Anytime you have to put water, including from fracking or from oil wells, where you've got oil and you've got saline, which is salt water, and you have those chemicals, you can create pressure, and that can create these thousands of micro leading to larger earthquakes. And it pollutes the air. No, I didn't know. We're investing in new genetically engineered stock. Do you know whether or not it can cause abnormalities within the genome of the person eating it? In other words, you eat a piece of genetically modified corn. How do you know at some level that your own cells are not becoming genetically modified? You don't. But that's not your concern. Return on the dollar is. And so we're looking at a very self-serving, highly aggressive, well-educated, extremely articulate class of people who frequently function as either policymakers or opinion leaders within their field. And then you have your entrepreneurial class. Now, the average entrepreneur or self-made person generally is making just enough to keep their business going and having a quality of life. They're the ones, more often than not, who have invested their life into their own business, and they own maybe a second home or original home in a gated community. There are over 20 million of these people. Now, do you see them out there in any of the movements to stop hydrofracking, to stop chemtrail spraying in the air, to stop the National Defense Authorization Act, or the loss of habeas corpus, or spying on people's phones? Do you find them out there joining together to try to help people whose homes are in foreclosure? Individually, you may find a few, but as a group, not at all. And they tend to be more conservative. They tend more often than not to believe in individualism. You work hard, and you deserve what you get. Well, what about the other people around you? Well, each person for themselves. There are certainly exceptions to that, but that's one of the things we don't appreciate, is how few people actually turn out, and who's turning out to rally, marching against Monsanto, or trying to stop Indian Point. It's mainly older progressives or younger idealists. So now we have 10 million millionaires. You have about 65 billionaires who are super billionaires, another 1,400 who are not as rich as the other billionaires. Big difference between 60 billion and 1 billion. And then you have your professional class, and then you have your upper middle class. Well, add those together, and they all have something in common. They're going to be supportive of anything that protects their assets, protects their future, and does not challenge their basic quality of life, their comforts, or their beliefs. That means, more often than not, conservative, or at the very most, they're willing to tolerate, let's say, libertarian. But what they generally do not accept are progressives, because they think progressive means socialist. It does not. Progressive means redistribution of all the wealth, taking all the wealth out of people's banks and distributing it equally. That is not. What a progressive means is looking for the truth, wherever it may be. And then you have a large group of people, your working class. These are public servants, frequently, governmental servants, bureaucrats, firefighters, police officers, school teachers, the people who help us function day to day to maintain some stability and quality of learning within our common experience. And then you have one of the largest groups, and that is the poor working class. These are people at one time were able to live and have a quality of life, but today cannot. They're working either not at all or underworking and are underpaid. Now, why are they underpaid? Not because the corporations they were working for don't have the money. The corporations had plenty of profit. But the corporations want to give that money to first the management in bonuses and also in options, but to the stockholders to keep the value of their stock high, because Wall Street says, if you start giving back money to the people who work for you, that's not good. Buy back your stock so you have less stock on the market, stock buybacks, that's good. Give higher bonuses to your management to show that they are deserving, and then surround yourself with a core of technocrats that never look at the ethics or legality of what you do. They're looking at the profitability. Hence, when you know, like Ford did with Pinto, that it was dangerous to drive it, they looked at how much they would make in selling the car versus how much it would cost to pay the damages, and it came down. It's the cost of doing business, just like with Vioxx. You sold $22 billion with the Vioxx, and it cost you $5 to $6 billion in settlement suits, and anywhere from 60 to 100 to 500,000 Americans died, and no one went to jail. Your reputation wasn't hurt, and the stock value went up because you got it behind you. And when you're a bank and you've laundered over $900 billion, with a B, billion dollars, in money from drug cartels for decades out of South and Central America and even terrorist groups, and you get caught, and you do, and you plead guilty, and you pay a paltry, $2 billion fine, yet you got to keep all your ill-gotten gains. In fact, everyone in corporate America gets to keep their ill-gotten gains, except if a person steals out of a grocery store because they're hungry, well, you have to give back what you stole, then you go to jail for 5 years. So clearly, we're living at a time where those who rule have a different set of rules for themselves. So understand when people say, oh, we got 1% and 99%, that is a myth, and it should be abolished. We have approximately, just do the math, we have 20 million, 10 million, about 8 million. So you're right there, you're close to 40 million Americans who are not going to side with you. Well, 40 million as a percentage of 330 million, now you're realizing, gee whiz, it's not 1%. It's closer to, well, let's see, it's closer to about 15%. So about 15% of Americans are not going to support change. They want either a Clinton Democrat, because that's a corporatist, and or they want a Trump, that's a corporatist, because either way, the people who control these people, who selected these people, who finance these people, win. The armament makers will keep getting more contracts and more jobs, and the rich don't care, because even though they have a higher supposedly a higher rate of taxes that they're going to be responsible for in their corporate gains, they never pay those gains because they know how to work that 60,000 plus tax code. So what happens is you see a collapse in the middle class, and that partly is because of robotics. Now you have a whole big fascination with bringing in machines to replace humans in all forms of areas that hitherto have not relied upon automated equipment. And yet, instead of as a nation taking a look, saying, what do we pay for this? What's it going to cost us in labor? Instead, we welcome it. If there's a new cell phone that is being manufactured robotically, which is actually the case with one of the new cell phones, there's no human beings has to touch it. It's all done by robots. Then what about the thousands of people that would have be given something, even if it was not a living wage? Well, too bad for them. I want my iPhone, and we'll have long lines standing up outside all night to get it. So greed and hubris, indifference and selfishness, a lack of both empathy and compassion, and a sense of I am important and I'm not one with Gaia or the world or anyone else. You got problems, deal with them. I want what I want, and I want it now. And so then you ask, well, how likely are we to make changes in fossil fuel? How likely are we to make any form of changes that would fundamentally ask a person, stop buying everything. We can't afford all this. You have to slow down. Do you really need most of what you buy? Isn't it based upon obsolescence? Doesn't it just become worthless very quickly? Yeah, but I still want it. But it's hurting the environment. It's hurting species. It's creating global warming. It's causing the excessive melting of the Arctic and Antarctic in Greenland. It's causing the melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas. What do I care? Because the Himalayas, which are the largest mountain range, the highest mountain range in the world, they have seven major rivers going into India and China and Vietnam that come from there. And these rivers are losing water flow. And they don't put the money into municipal improvements like cleaning up the water. So people are becoming sick and dying because of that. And the cities don't have the money to build the people who are living in slum conditions livable housing. And they have run out of water in India, and they're having the hottest days in the history of the country right now. One day last week in one community in India, it hit 160 degrees. People died. Well, what happens when you run out of water and you have excessive drought and heat? Then you can't plant crops. Seeds will die. What happens when that happens? Well, where are people supposed to get their food? They're a non-sustainable community. India is not sustainable. What's the government doing? How about nothing? How about the Middle East? They took in no refugees. No, they created the crisis that led to refugees. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. How many of the refugees from Syria and how many of the refugees from Libya and Yemen did they take in? How about zero? They let them all go to Europe. Well, they were responsible for the problem. Well, they're running out of water also. And they're running out of profit in oil. So do you see the problems? People who are very rich can always fly somewhere else and have a home somewhere else, have food from somewhere else, and have servants from somewhere else. How about the rest of the people? They die, they suffer, or they adapt somewhere else. Well, what if you don't have the money to get on a boat? What if you're in the middle of Africa? What if you're one of the 300 million people who are right now without water, adequate water, clean water, and seeds to plant, and when you do have a seed, it won't grow because it's too hot, and you're suffering from drought? Too bad. And that's 12 million people right now are affected in just one country in Africa. Do we hear about it? No, we do not, because it does not impact the wealthier classes. And now we have the collapse of the middle class. Our middle class jobs are disappearing. That fact may be disputed by the free market advocates who want us to believe when Barack Obama says, what did he just say, quote, we're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. Not true. The evidence shows that living wage, family-sustained positions are quickly being replaced by lower wage and less secure forms of employment. These plentiful low-level jobs have padded the unemployment figures, leaving much of America believing in an overhyped recovery. New research is beginning to confirm the permanent nature of middle-class job loss. Not only are we losing these middle-class jobs, they're not coming back, ever. Not only do we have the problem with robotics destroying jobs, but now we have special visas where you pay a price for a visa, you come in the United States, you have a PhD, and you're going to take the place and be trained by a person who's been there for 25 years, who's making $200,000 or $150,000 a year with benefits, and you're willing to work for $40,000 and no benefits. And now there are millions of these people coming in, all legally. Well, what about the American work ethic? What about we're the hardest working people? That is true. There's no country that you can show that works longer hours, harder, and is more stressed just to make a living. And yet the average person can't make a living. And those who make more than a living are not working for a living. They're working for a standard of living they don't want to see gone. So now you have these visas that are going to take about 8 million jobs. They've taken millions already. You're going to have robotics. You have outsourcing of corporate interest. You're going to buy a company because it's got a good brand name. You're going to outsource it, and then those people can lose their jobs, and then they become invisible. So that brings us to the idea of how bad is it? Well, it's getting a lot worse. I'm not going to talk about Latin America, the Middle East, North Africa, East Asia. I'm going to just talk about North America because that's where we have the big problems. We now are seeing extreme levels of social polarization present, and that is challenging the dominant groups. According to an article by William I. Robinson in Truthout, this is the new norm. Why? Because they strive to purchase the loyalty of that about figure in the neighborhood of about 20%, 15 to 20%. While at the same time, they're dividing up all the other groups, these hegemonic blocks. Those who have power want to make sure that they surround themselves with other people who want to be a part of their social system. And as a result, another strategy is co-opting and manipulating by fear and insecurity among the downwardly mobile so that social anxiety is channeled towards scapegoating communities. It's working. The psychosocial mechanisms of displacing mass anxiety is not new. but it appears to be increasing around the world. And the fact of structural destabilization, of capitalist globalization, is occurring. When you scapegoat, let's say if you're in Myanmar, and you scapegoat the Rohingya, and then the Muslim minority in India, and the Kurds in Turkey, and the Southern African immigrants in South Africa, and the Syrian Iraqi refugees and other immigrant groups, then they have no power. You've made them look bad. You've made them look like a threat. Extreme inequality requires extreme violence, and that requires extreme repression that leads to extreme fascism. When Bo O'Reilly is talking about how bad it is today because the black families don't have fathers, that's not the problem. The problem is not a lack of fathers. Of course families do best when they have a loving mother and father working cooperatively to raise the child. Bill, what you forgot to mention was that a good example of almost a perfect community in America to live for decades was Camden, New Jersey. They had zero unemployment. They had a high standard of living. People had living wages, savings, no debt, and they worked in different major industries, including the ship industry. And yet when those jobs closed down, when they were exported to other areas of America or outside the United States, there was no replacement, there was no retraining. So when you take away the support of a community, you're going to cripple that community, and then you're going to end up with extreme deprivation, and from extreme deprivation, you're going to get crime. And it doesn't mean everyone in that community who is poor has a criminal mindset. The vast majority of poor people in any community are not criminals. They are victims of crime. But you don't look for the truth, because the truth wouldn't serve your ideological interest. There have been five previous mass extinctions in Earth's history. But for the first time, we are the cause, not nature. Capitalism is the cause. It is not solely responsible, but it's right up there. And, for example, when you overpopulate, like Sumerian Empire, it collapsed after population oversalinated the crop soil. So when you have beautiful, pristine forests, and you cut them down to supply soybeans or lumber for developing economies that want a better standard of living, you're not looking at the consequences. Consequences, you tear down the rainforest, that's the lungs of a planet. It absorbs CO2. It helps prevent global warming. You don't care about that. You're caring about how much money you're going to make on a commodity that people need because they've been told to have meat, have hamburgers, have steaks, have fried chicken. And so you're giving it to them and not once looking at the consequences. The Mayan city-state network collapsed about 900 AD due to deforestation. Environmental catastrophe can resolve itself within the capitalist system, and it will. Because no matter how rich you are, how much you control, you cannot control the outcome of a tornado, a hurricane, an earthquake, and they're all happening. Excessive drought and uncontrolled rain where you don't want it. The sheer magnitude of the means of violence is unprecedented, as is the concentration control over the means of global communications and the production and circulation of knowledge and symbols and images. We've seen the spread of frightening new systems of social control and repression that have brought us to the surveillance society state, the age of thought control. We are now living in a real Orwellian world, and we have given up our critical capacity to think, to judge, to challenge, to protest. Even protest today of any kind is considered an act of civil disobedience and puts you on an FBI and Homeland Security watch list. Global apartheid involves the creation of green zones. Now, I've mentioned this many times on the program. I believe in the United States right now we have probably in the neighborhood of about 1,000 green zones. Now, a green zone is an area sometimes as small as a gated community with a golf course, sometimes as large as the west side and east side of Manhattan and downtown Manhattan, but also right outside of the green zone, you have no green zone, which means that you do not have the protection of a larger social contract. You're considered disposable. And inside the green zone, it is supposed to be protected. So there's a concentration of wealth, and where there's a concentration of wealth, there's a concentration of services, because the wealthy want what they want when they want it, and they don't want to be in any way interfered with. They don't want to see a march down the street. They don't want to see anyone holding a sign up saying, your greed caused my hunger. They don't want to see that. The command center of the occupation is in every city in the United States. Urban areas around the world are now emulating the green zone and the gentrification of gated communities, the surveillance systems, the state and private violence. And inside the world of green zones, privileged strata avail themselves of privileged social services. You're there to consume, and you're there to consume what other people outside the zone cannot afford or even imagine. You're to be entertained because you can afford the entertainment. And you also control the internet. You control the communications. You own satellites. You have the capacity to be protected by private armies, police, private security forces. Green zones are the new desired place. And if you want to know what a green zone looked like, go to Israel. And then be in Gaza, be in the West Bank, and try to get out. You have apartheid walls surrounding it. By the way, Mexico City also has a green zone. The most exclusive residential areas in the upscale Santa Fe district. And you can only get in by helicopter or private gated roads. It's constantly manned by security agents. In Johannesburg, a surreal drive through the exclusive Sandton City area reveals row of mansion after mansion after mansion, and every single mansion looks like a military compound. Armed private towers, electrical and barbed wire fences. In Cairo, all you have to do is get a satellite view and you'll see the entire city of Cairo, one of the largest populated cities in the world, is ringed by these very unique, exclusive compounds. That's where those who have the wealth and the privilege with green lawns and private leisure and shopping centers and English language international schools, all protected by the military checkpoints and private security. Try to get in, you can't. Try to get out of Gaza, you can't. Try to go through a checkpoint at Gaza, even if you have an emergency, even if you're dying, even if you need an ambulance, they'll let you die. In other cities, green zoning is subtler, but no less effective. In Los Angeles, the freeway system now has an express lane reserved for those who can pay an exorbitant toll. On this lane, the privileged speed by while the rest remain one lane over, stuck in the city's notorious bumper-to-bumper traffic, or even worse, in notoriously underfunded and undeveloped public transportation. And there's no barrier, by the way, separating this express lane from the others. However, there's an entire surveillance system in the entire process that if you move from that regular person lane into the express lane, you will immediately get fined, heavy fines. And the threat of impoundment of your car and the highway police are everywhere. But that's for the wealthy, not for the others. Outside the global green zones, you have warfare and police containment, and that's normal. Sanitizing areas, sanitizing cities, that's normal. Destroying everything in a culture, no matter how important it was historically, that's normal. The people portrayed today are glamorized. We glamorize war, we glamorize the soldier, we glamorize violence and television. The most popular video games are those that are most violent. And so this is the new sense of sadistic capitalism. It desensitizes, bringing about complacency and indifference. So I believe in the next 3 to 5 years, you will see over 1,000 green zones around the United States, and your whole effort is to get them. Now go back to what I originally said. How did they get away with this? How did they get away with having 200,000 military contractors all creating things we don't need that are going to be obsolete for profit plus from the Pentagon? Well, they were smart. They hired ex-Pentagon officials, admirals, generals, joint chiefs of staff. They hired ex-legislators, senators who sat on military committees, armaments committees. And then they realized how much money they can make because the American public knows these are never going to be audited and they can go on forever. So on the one hand, where the conservatives say we want small government, it is the conservatives or the conservative Democrat like Bill Clinton has given the biggest government spending in history. We have the military-industrial complex. That's $1.5 trillion a year on and off the books. We have the medical-industrial complex. That's $3.5 trillion. Put the two together, you've got $5 trillion, and yet are we saving people by spending all this money? We're more hospitals, doctors, nurses, drugs? No. In fact, a new article I have coming out later this week will show that American medicine is the number one cause of injury and death in the United States, and it has been for decades. So why can't we change it? We can't change because the people who control it are not going to allow change. We give you the impression when running for office that some change will happen. Remember Barack Obama? None of it becomes true once they're in office. They go to where the money and security for themselves is, and everybody wants to be around people where they're more secure. So you don't want to be in a middle-class neighborhood or a lower-middle-class neighborhood or poor neighborhood because you're not going to feel safe there. You want to have your safety, you want to have your pleasures, and you can only have that in green zones. So I see the green zoning of the world, and everywhere I go, I see more and more of it, and it's only going to become more radicalized. And then for everyone else, you're on your own. But we've reached the limits of what we can take from nature without imbalancing it in the extreme. A good statement from William I. Robinson was, quote, "Capitalism is like riding a bicycle. When you stop pedaling the bicycle, you fall over. If the capitalist system stops expanding outward, it enters crisis and faces collapse. In each earlier structural crisis, the system went through a new round of extensive expansion, from waves of colonial conquest in earlier centuries to the integration of the late 20th century and 21st centuries of the former socialist countries, China and India, and other areas that have been marginally outside the system. There are no longer any new territories to integrate into world capitalism. Meanwhile, the privatization of education, healthcare, utilities, basic services, and public land are turning those spaces into global society that were outside of capitalist control into spaces of capital. Even poverty has been turned into a commodity. What there is left to commodify, and so that is where we're at. And we have militarized accumulation, making wars of endless destruction, not because we want to bring peace, freedom, and democracy to Iraq, to Afghanistan, but we want their assets. And we want regime change that will support the long-term asset. How do we know? They told us. When did they tell us? Back in the 1990s. They actually put it in writing that they wanted the regime change in Iraq, Libya, Sudan, let's see what else. It was Iran and in Syria. And to get there, they were going to do whatever they had to do. And who told us that? Leslie Clark, a four-star former commander of NATO, because he read it and had it said to him while at the Defense Department, and that was before 9/11. So they have an agenda, they have the power, they own the media, they control the curriculum, they control the textbooks, they control agriculture, they control banking, they want to limit cash or eliminate cash, they want to give you all the idea that you have a value, the only value you have, is as a commodity. Now, let me give you the final statement before we go to our guest. Here is what they have not told you. We have been lied to. We've been told that our official gross domestic product to our debt is about 105%, meaning $19.2 trillion in national debt, $18.2 trillion in gross domestic product. How stupid do they think we are? Fact. The U.S. total debt is $64.8 trillion, and that includes national debt, budget deficit, state debt, and total interest on the unpaid on the debt. And that gives you a 350% debt to gross domestic product. Then add in personal debt, $17 trillion, $13 trillion in mortgages, $1.3 trillion student debt, and that's about $54,000 per person. Then also bring in your credit card debt of almost $1 trillion. Then unfunded liabilities, meaning liabilities that must be paid, but they don't have the money, $1.2 trillion. Social Security liability, even though that should never have been touched, but they took over $2.3 trillion out of Social Security, and we have too many people retiring, not enough young people taking their place, we're going to need an additional $14.9 trillion. Medicare liability, $27.6 trillion. That gives us a total new actual debt of $226 trillion. So our real, listen carefully, everyone, our real debt to gross domestic product is 1,230%. We are bankrupt. We will never pay this back, and we have no intention of paying it back. And yet we criticize Greece with 210% debt, gross domestic product. Italy at 139, Portugal at 131, China at 65, and Russia at only 15%. And we say that we are the wise financial people of the world with trickle-down economics. We are not. We are fools. Let's go over and say hello to my guest standing by, Dr. Jim Garrison. He gave you his background a little earlier. And Jim is also the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power, as well as Civilization and the Transformation of Power. Jim has graduate degrees in theology and religion from Harvard University and Cambridge University. His website is wisdomuniversity.org and ubiquityuniversity.org. Nice to have you with us, Jim.
Thank you, Gary. Always a pleasure.
Jim, we now have people running for president, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump, who all say that they're going to make change for the average person. They're going to deal with Wall Street. They're going to deal with minority problems. They're going to deal with our prison problems. I don't see any of them really doing much of anything, and I see two of them doing absolutely nothing but continuing what has already happened. And yet they will lie right to your face and get away with it, especially the Clintons. So I'd like you to address the following, please. How politicians present themselves as something to influence citizens, then flip once in office, particularly Clinton Obama, imposing as liberals and progressives when they don't have a true liberal and progressive bone in their body, they're acting like rabid conservative Republicans. And since you're an expert on the Soviet Union and World War II, can you also speak a little bit about the departure of Obama and Hillary from democratic principles that once held sway in America towards totalitarian policies and actions? The forum is yours.
Wow, that was a huge, very dimensionalized question. So I would say at the outset that what I could probably say in a few minutes is just a number of perspectives that might shed some light on it. Let me start with Obama. And I think that you're absolutely right. The tragedy of Barack Obama is that he came into office in the aftermath of the literally catastrophic failure of the Bush administration. And the American polity so desperate for transformational leadership that they did something highly unusual. They voted into office a black man for the first time in U.S. history. And it's worth recalling that the world gave him the Nobel Peace Prize before he even took office. He came into office with majority control of both the House and the Senate. And literally the world, and I think the United States, really waited breathlessly for this young man who had spoken so powerfully and eloquently about the audacity of hope. And then when he came in, he proceeded to squander his moral and political capital with such egregious disregard for the opportunity for greatness that history had afforded to him that 8 years later, the political situation in the United States has reached a point where the paralysis of 8 years of squandered leadership has produced a situation of extremis. And the anger, the need for transformation, Gary, in my mind, 8 years later has sunk into the morass of anger and rage. And so if you look at Trump on the right and Sanders on the left, you have the politics of extremists. And I think a comment that I would make that was actually made by Andrew Sullivan, if you saw his piece on Trump 2 weeks ago in New York Magazine, he makes the point drawn from Plato's Republic, which is Plato's great critique of democracy. He says that democracy unfettered will result in excessive promiscuity and liberty, and at a certain point, the undisciplined morass of the mob will generate a tyrant. And I think that's what Trump represents in the American political history. It's in some ways the death knell of a political tradition that has been so promiscuous about its power, its freedom, its place in the world, that it's ended up exactly as you described in the first 10 minutes of this call. And that can't happen indefinitely. And what Plato predicts is that a democratic system then will produce a tyrant that manifests all the excesses of the democracy itself. So if you look at Trump, he exemplifies all those egregious accents of a democracy run riot, as it were. And then he comes in and he takes over and creates a tyranny, as Plato called it. And then the whole thing collapses on itself. And what Andrew Sullivan said is that America needs to understand that Donald Trump is an extinction level event. And he's bringing to a close a level of excess. And so you have someone that looks like it's going to be Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton is really the representative of what in the French revolutionary model would be the ancient regime, the monarchy. She's endorsing everything about Barack Obama. She comes out of the tradition of Bill Clinton. She represents the elites and the establishment. And the choice that apparently the American political tradition, 235 years after our founding, has come to is a choice of a bankrupt elite against a tyrant that will come in and muscle his way and will certainly break up the political apparatus, but do it in a way that will destroy the very institutions that made America what it meant to the world. So that would be the first point that I would make. Another point that I would make, drawn from history, you mentioned the Soviet Union and Germany and so forth, is the following. I mean, if you look at the rise and fall of the Soviet Empire and the rise and fall of the Nazis, they rose and fell out of a political certitude that became the antithesis of the democratic process. And Hannah Arendt, in her masterful work, A Study of Tyranny, written in the aftermath of the Second World War, she said that what the Soviet Union did first and what the Nazis did second, which is a possibility for the United States in the aftermath of a Donald Trump. Right now, we're looking at Donald Trump slightly with humor, slightly with bewilderment, slightly with awe that somebody could come in and by the sheer force of personality, break up a political structure that Americans have really thought was God-given, providentially decreed, our Constitution. And we're watching almost like, you know, the doe caught in the headlights of an oncoming car, someone by a force of will, you know, going back to Nietzsche's, the Übermensch, by force of will, destroying the political apparatus right in front of us. And what Hannah Arendt says happens at that moment, if we're not careful, particularly with the instrumentality of mass control that you were identifying, these are not idle statistical facts. These are probability functions now in a bankrupt political system that if we're not careful, she said, what the mass psychology of tyranny is when the entire system inverts itself. And we have, for example, the Mosaic Covenant and the Judeo-Christian Covenant. You know, we want, you're good and God will bless you. You're bad and God will punish you. but in a tyranny of the proportions of a totalitarian tyranny that's now possible in the United States, the entire moral ethic turns itself on its head. And that's what made the Soviet system and the Nazi system so overwhelmingly powerful, is that ethics itself was inverted. And when you did the evil, you were rewarded. And when you did the good, you were punished. And in the face of that inversion, the world kind of stood still, and we saw what happened in the aftermath of the Nazis, culminating in the Second World War and the Holocaust and Hiroshima and Nagasaki and so forth. So I would say that this election coming up is a watershed election in American history. If Trump is elected, I think it means the demise of any kind of democracy as we know it. And it's interesting to go back to Plato, and I would recommend Andrew Solomon's article for every one of your readers. You can Google it. It's New York Magazine 2 weeks ago. And just Google Andrew Sullivan. He says, in a paradoxical way, the only thing that stands in the way of the tyrant now in the United States are the elites. And I say this having been very critical of Hillary Clinton, but in the Plato's Republic and in Andrew Sullivan's analysis of Trump, it is only the elites now that can stop a Donald Trump. And let me close this opening remark, Gary, by saying the following. After I read Andrew Sullivan's article, I was traveling in Europe, and I saw on Netflix a two-hour docudrama of Adolf Hitler and the rise of Adolf Hitler. And it was very interesting. When Hitler in 1932 rose in power and the Nazis began to develop a presence in the Reichstag, it came down to a decision among the elites. Were they going to take him on, or were they going to adopt him, even though they knew he was a psychopath? We all know that Donald Trump is a psychopath. That's just true. We know it.
I understand, but we're up to the end of the program. I would suggest one thing, that I would hate to think that we have to rely upon the people who put us in this mess and have no capacity to get us out, because I look at all of them as being psychopaths. And so I think that we have to look in a different place. I think we have to look for the young idealists and the older pragmatists to work together and withdraw from their system. As long as we continue to buy their food, watch their television, buy their clothes, then we are allowing ourselves to be affected and enabling them. And I believe that whether it's having a Hillary Clinton, you're looking at war. It's inevitable, then, that Israel will attack Iran, and she's going to continue to poke Russia through NATO, so she's looking for another Cold War. I don't see any of these. The only option I see that is humane, that would not provoke an international conflict, would be Jill Stein as running partner with Bernie Sanders. That, I think, would make sense. Beyond that, and he has 41% of the American population are independents. They're not going to vote for, most will not vote for Clinton or Trump, but they would vote for a Sanders and a
But let me make a let me make a narrower point. I think it's very interesting right now in the Republican Party that the Bushes, the Paul Ryans, Mitt Romney, the elites of the Republican Party are resisting Trump, and I think that's very important. I think it's very important what you're saying, but I'm afraid that Joel Stein and others are not going to be on the ballot and are not going to make a difference by this November. And I
neither
from
you're right. You're probably right. But
yeah,
then again, they could start a whole new movement. And even though they wouldn't have power, they would be a counterbalance to the power that gets elected. We would have been far ahead in this movement had we voted with Ralph Nader and supported him when he was not elected, we would have movements to counterbalance the excesses that have occurred since then. We have nothing counterbalancing the excesses of bombing.
As Abraham Lincoln said, politics is the art of the possible. And what's possible right now in the United States, apparently, is a choice between Trump and Clinton. And if Trump becomes the Republican nominee, I just have a fear in the pit of my stomach that he could be the next president of the United States. And as highly paradoxical as this may seem, and we're in a situation of political extremists, as I indicated at the beginning, it may be the elites in the Republican Party, if they resist Trump and deny him the nomination or come in with a third-party movement, that may allow the progressives. And remember, Hillary Clinton is corrupt. I completely understand that. And she represents the status quo. But I think she would be immeasurably preferable to a Donald Trump.
Well, Donald Trump didn't create Libya or Syria. Regime change in Honduras, Hillary did. So that's a matter for us to discuss on another program. But in any case, remember, there's always the FBI. There is always an indictment that could derail her. So let's hope for the best. Jim, thank you as always for being on the program. I appreciate it. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.